Saturday, March 13th. My dear friends, Jim Kane and Willis Terst are house guests, and this morning they completed the purpose of their visit, an examination of Lyndon. Essentially, everything is fine, all the basic organs and functioning thereof, but there is this heavy load of tension and this fog of depression. If you're enjoying what you do, you don't get tired no matter how hard you work. And if it's frustrating and full of uncertainties, you use up energy struggling against what you have to do. In a nutshell, their prescription is exercise, diet, and a break. That is, get off to sunshine and rest for a couple of days every 2 weeks, or at the very outside once a month. I adore Camp David. I would simply love to go out on the boat. I'd like to go to Puerto Rico or the Virgin Islands. But Lyndon feels chained right here, and it's having an erosive effect on his personality. When I walked out of the room about 10 o'clock this morning, the loom was thick enough to cut with a knife. The major decision that must be faced is having a press conference. And where should it be, and shall it be televised? And what can he say that will pull together these roiling masses of humanity, the Negroes in Selma and the white folks in Selma, and the preachers and students and folks from all over the United States who've come down there to add their say to the situation? Amazingly enough, when I went back in the room, Lyndon must have touched some inner spring, some untapped resource, because he sounded ready to go out and face the world, to take it on. He was in a completely different humor, and that facing the prospect of meeting Governor Wallace at noon. Linda and Dave and I went bowling after 1 o'clock, and I did the best I've ever done, more than 120, all the time wondering what was going on with Lyndon and Governor Wallace. It turns out they had about a two-hour session. I had a nice little farewell visit with the two doctors and was touched that they considered me also and urged me to get at least a one-day respite in the middle of the week by going to Camp David or Huntland's. And then at 3:30, I went down to the Rose Garden with Linda and Dave to watch the press conference. There must have been 300 newspaper people there. A beautiful sunny day, thank heavens. Cool, but not cold. And Lyndon, composed, in charge, in command of the situation. I thought it was a great performance. I would as soon be thrown to the wolves. But he could put his tongue with the right expression. The pickets are still with us. There are 1,000 of them are here. Their noise has almost ceased to bother me. Tonight is our party for the Dukes. I had planned it as the gayest thing we do, for people that we loved especially. And the guest list was gilded with the young and lovely, good dancers, good talkers. Nevertheless, I had awaited it with dread, that the country would be in such a black mood, that Lyndon would be under such a pall, that it would be impossible to have fun. Unexplainably, did some delicious little thing happen this morning, or was it just a sheer effort of will? The pall lifted, and tonight is going to be fun. I was ready early and went downstairs with Robin and Angie. It was delightful to stand in the line and greet practically every person as somebody I wanted especially to see. From the cabinet, there were the Dillons and the McNamaras and the Udalls, the Freemans, the Connors, the Wirtzes, and Whizzer White from the Supreme Court because he's such a good dancer. From the Senate, the John Sherman Coopers, Mike Monroney, Gail and Lorraine McGee, the Claiborne Pales, he with a black patch over one of his eyes, so that you practically wanted to ask him where his cape was, and the young Birch Byes. I always want to hand her 2 milkshakes, but so full of life and so nice to our 2 girls. And, delightfully, at the party, there was a Rockefeller, a Vanderbilt, and an Astor, the Lawrence Rockefellers. I feel I've come to know them quite well over the beautification. And a lovely divorcee, Mrs. Jean Murray Vanderbilt, Lyndon's special friend, exquisite in a gold brocade. And Mrs. Vincent Astor, whom I'd met through her Harlem project, an outdoor living room, she calls it. It's a park playground project. I was especially delighted to see the family of Angie and Robin. Robin's mother, remarkably beautiful for a lady of her years. Angie's mother, who is of no years at all. She's completely fey, out of this world, and lives by her own rules. You have the feeling the only criterion is it amusing? Robin's sister, Mrs. Ridley of Atlanta and her husband, and Angie's brother, Anthony Drexel Duke. What a collection of illustrious names. I couldn't help but remember their wedding party, at which I had met a very attractive lady who said something unbelievable like this. I used to be so-and-so's sister-in-law, and now I am again. Mary Lasker was there, and the William Randolph Hearst, and Jane and Charles Engelhard, she in an absolutely fabulous dress that she should have had a portrait painted in by Van Dyke if he was still living, and from the communications media, the David Brinkleys, the John Chancellors, the Wyatt Dickersons. Nancy was full of news about the lovely house they had bought that had belonged to Mrs. Kennedy's mother, Mrs. Auchincloss, where Senator and Mrs. Kennedy used to live for a while after they were first married, the Leonard Goldensons, the Bob Kentners, Bill Lawrence, and handsome Eric Severide with his statuesque, lovely wife, and the cute young Jimmy Symington's, who always remind me how long I've been around this town. Bess had done delightful things, handing the gentleman a facsimile of a ambassadorial appointment saying you have just been appointed ambassador to, and then hilarious names of countries such as Rumorania, Nixonagra, Inland, each table being identified with an amusing drawing and the title of such a grass-dark country. I still was jittery about the toast, but I needn't have been. Lyndon was never in better form. The toast was good itself. And then he launched into some great stories about Senator Green. That was after Angie's deft and charming toast, in which Senator Green had figured. And Lyndon had the whole state dining room roaring. Not to be outdone, at some point, I lifted my glass to Angie and Robin with about three sentences of very deeply felt gratitude for their efficiency and industry all wrapped up in such a gay and charming cloak. People clapped for me, and for once I felt that what I had said had been well said, a good antidote to these last few months of a steady diet of not being pleased with myself. Then we danced, I constantly, until far into the night. It was after 1:30 when we went upstairs, taking with us Bill Walton, Gene Vanderbilt, who was his date, Dickersons and the Abels. The latter beat as quick a retreat as courtesy permitted. Linda had been one of the stars of the evening. She had looked lovely in her yellow inaugural dress. Guest after guest commented to me about how attractive and dear she was. I value Mac George Bundy's opinion almost most of all because he'd worked with her last summer. Actually, when I'm looking for a husband for one of the girls, I'm looking for a young Mac George Bundy, unfortunately in scarce supply. There were so many beautiful women there, and I was very proud of the women who work in Lyndon's vicinity, the wives of his staff members, Judith Moyers, Anne Hand, not staff but close, Mary Margaret, and Marion Watson. And I was proud of many of those that we had added to the government, or at least advanced to more important posts, Tom Mann, Sheldon Cohen, Lloyd Hand. It was a good day. I felt like we were back in midstream again,